This edition of The Review was first broadcast on Monocle 24 on February 18th, 2012. Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio 2 here on Monocle 24, with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's program, we'll hear what's taking readers' fancy in bookstores in Seoul, Lisbon, and Warsaw.
So it's a bookstore with a coffee shop and a place to meet. We have meetings with authors frequently, so it's more than a bookstore.
If you couldn't guess, that was a bookstore in Warsaw, not in Seoul. We'll also be heading to New Zealand to get some music recommendations from music producer Christopher Tubbs.
And we'll be reviewing a new stack of magazines from architecture to business.
All that right here on The Review, live on Monocle 24. And welcome to Studio 2 here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, and Gillian DeBias. Hello, Gillian.
Hello, nice to have you back, Tyler.
Nice to be back.
So 2 weeks, all right. Yeah. Give us the highlights.
Not the highlight, but I was on my way here this morning and was just, you know, running out the door. I landed about 6 a.m. from Bangkok and just... You know, you always hear these excuses in the UK, which are always like, you know, people always talk about their boilers being broken. So I was, you know, on my way here, ready to start the show, and I was about to jump in the shower, and there was no water.
Well,
there's no hot
water.
I know. Welcome back to the UK. A very not particularly warm welcome back. But anyway, thankfully we have a shower here. So anyway, you're not stuck with a stinky version of me in the studio. But it was a good 2 week trip. I was in Singapore, and you probably heard the check-ins as I was going around the world. Then I was in Seoul. Then I was in Tokyo. Then down in Fukuoka. Then back up in Tokyo, then jumped over to Honolulu, and then it was Honolulu, Tokyo, Bangkok, home. So it's been something of a proper tour of the Asia Pacific region, but interesting. And Honolulu was mostly holiday with family, which was great. And if anyone's been reading the FT this morning,
I was going to say, what's your read of the place? Because you go back a lot. So.
Yeah, it has become an annual trip, and I think it's so outpost like in many ways. And I think many people, you know, I think a lot of people who maybe know it superficially see this place, which is a bit of a Las Vegas, in the middle of the Pacific. But I think there's an interesting tension right now, and I met some really some quite interesting people, young journalists as well, who I think are really looking west, meaning west, they're looking across the Pacific, and they see the relationship is with Manila, and they see that the relationship is with Japan and maybe with New Zealand and Australia, and that it's, you know, that maybe the future is not so much with the U.S. West Coast or the U.S. in general, of course, you know, being the 50th state. And even if you look at numbers, I was talking to the gentleman who runs the Halekulani where I was staying. He said Japanese tourists now account for over 60% of their guests.
That's huge.
Then it's Americans around 20-ish percent, and then it's Aussies and then Canadians. So it's incredible that what you have 80% is non-US tourists. And so
what would be the appeal with Hawaii as opposed to, say, the Caribbean?
It is the weather. It is the trade winds. It's funny. I felt like, because when I went to when I was in Bangkok yesterday, getting on the plane, even at 11 o'clock at night, it made Australia, it made Honolulu feel like it was Sweden, temperature-wise. You know, it's a wonderful sort of 26, 27 degrees, and, you know, Bangkok was, you know, a sweltering 33.
But right back, and then you were saying Seoul. What was your mission there?
Mission in Seoul was, we actually had a small cocktail party. It was actually the first sort of this, what has become a bit of a global tour this month of party. So there was a small cocktail in Seoul for subscribers and our collaborators in that market. We did something in Tokyo the other evening. And then there was Budapest last night. I was supposed to be in Budapest, but I got called to Bangkok. So I was there. And then we've got a big party in London coming up on Tuesday evening.
Yes. And I have my film all ready to go.
All ready to go, which we're going to look at as soon as we get off the air. Yeah. And then also we're in New York the week after next. Your good friend and my good friend Danny Lopez, who's now the Consul General in New York, is going to be hosting us, which is
which is British Consul General in New York.
Yeah, which is great. So that'll be, and that's going to be at, I think it's the new residence. I think the old residence used to be on Fifth Avenue. I'm not sure.
Not one that's been sold off, because when we were looking in the newspapers about the article about sort of assets that are being sold off around the world, and I think embassies and consulates are some of the assets that the Brits are selling off.
Yeah, you picked up on something which is just, you know, we've been talking about it for, you know, quite a while, and I wrote an editorial about it recently, but in the Independent center spread, page 32, 33 of the Independent this morning, there's just, it's the fire sale, everything must go, and they've sampled and just sort of looked at everywhere from Ireland to Spain to France to Italy, just seeing states are selling off. You look at some of the things, i.e., as you mentioned, the UK, you know, getting rid of military equipment, as much as also getting rid of embassies. And you think that there's a certain basement that you hit where you have the pride and dignity of a nation, and there's certain things you can't get rid of.
Well, as a country, I think, yes, it makes sense to have a yard sale and get rid of certain things to help boost your economy, not your embassies and consulates.
No. And partly because whenever you speak to ambassadors, they will always tell you that, of course, it's very hard to justify them, when times are bad. But when times are good, how many contracts do they win? And of course, it is about having a presence on the world stage. And we did that story just in the run-up to Christmas. And, we were talking to Klaus Holm, who was the ex-director of public diplomacy for the Danish foreign ministry. And, he was the one who really talks about sort of the laptop diplomat and just saying, do you reach a point where your government is going to really be Britain brought to you by Intercontinental or brought to you by Marriott? Because that's where all the meetings happen. And what kind of presence can you have, other than maybe a few like little cocktail flags stuck into some wieners on top of a table that sort of say, okay, you're at the British table at the lobby of a Marriott hotel, which is kind of pathetic. What did you find in the paper? Anything?
Well, I mean, I after the show wraps and I show you my film, I'm going to be heading down to Somerset House because that's going to be home for London Fashion Week.
Is that the hub this year?
That's the hub this year. It was at the National Natural History Museum for a while. Now it's at Somerset House. And I think it's a good base for it because all around it, the courtyard, there are offices. And the offices are the showrooms for a new generation small businesses, and really reflects complete sort of sea change of where now Britain really is starting to get its act together to realize it can't just be about showmanship. It just can't be about raw talent. It has to be able to turn it into business. Mm. And I think that's why, I'm finding it particularly interesting this time.
Well, that's one of the questions that came up when I was in Singapore and Seoul. Almost asks after the UK, which I found is quite interesting. So how is England? I think there is that.
Like
sense
your elderly aunt.
Yeah, it is. It's like how are they doing in the old age home? And it's curious. When you're in a place like Singapore, Seoul, even Japan as well. I mean, Japan has its own set of problems, but we were with actually the Prime Minister's office there, and there's an interesting project on the horizon in Japan where coming up to the anniversary of March 11 and the earthquake and tsunami. I think we're going to see also sort of quite a big concerted push on the part of the PM's team to really, push forward. Japan wants to win the 2020 Olympics. Mm. So I think you're going to see this renewed energy. And people ask after London and also they feel about the Olympics and what's going to happen. And so I think there's...
But when we're talking about embassies for a country, but fashion is a great ambassador for Britain if they get it right.
Absolutely.
And if they get it right, it does travel. If you think of, the Stella McCartneys and the Queens and Vivienne Westwood way back when. But, fashion not only can be a great ambassador, but if they do get it right, and the talk is now of trying to do government initiatives to do apprenticeship, traineeships, and encourage manufacturing back in the UK.
And that's what we've always said as well, is that to be able to, and it's when even it was interesting in America or being in the States and just seeing that there was GE's has a new campaign, which is about, talks about America sort of working. And I felt a lot of the discussion just watching, the US programs when I was in Honolulu, it's all about bringing jobs back to America. I mean, you saw Obama's speech when he was in Wisconsin last week. Mm-hmm. It's why this is better for the country, why it makes sense logistically, why it makes sense, from an energy point of view. And it would be nice if number 10 got that message.
Yeah, well, I'll go check it out. All right, well, moving along, you're listening to the review here on Monocle 24. And now it's time to check in with our independent bookshops around the world to hear what's doing well this week in their stores.
And first up is Virginie Vijata, I'm going to do that again. I can do better with my Polish. It's Virginie Sviata, which stands for the Boiling of the World Bookshop in Warsaw.
Cześć, Gabriela. Witam w księgarni Wrzeni Świata. Usiądźmy może.
I'm Tomasz Grajkowski. I'm the bookstore manager in Wrzeni Świata. I guess the only bookstore with mostly non-fiction books. The bookstore was founded by Polish Institute of Reportage, so no wonder we are mostly focused on reportage books, on biography, broadly speaking, non-fiction. So it's... bookstore with a coffee shop and a place to meet. We have meeting with authors frequently, so it's more than a bookstore. the best-selling books in our bookstore was number one, Freedom Climbers by Canadian journalist Bernadette MacDonald. It is about the golden era of Polish climbing in Himalaya. Kukuczka, Rutkiewicz, Wielicki in the 70s and 80s were dominating in the Himalaya despite of the communist era and problems with passports and money and so on. They were really strong. Second one, it's best-selling since December, is Dzienniki Kołymskie by Polish reporter Jacek Hugo Bader. How could we translate it? Kolyma Diaries. Kolyma is a part of Russia, Siberian cold, and this is about his trip to this region. Very interesting and really good selling because people are wondering about this unknown area. And number three, a book by a Swedish journalist, The German Fall. It's interesting because the book was first published in Swedish in, I guess, late 40s or early 50s, and it could not be published in Poland due to the political reasons. This first edition of this book, and this is a classical reportage. It's about the ordinary lives in Germany immediately after the war, when the Germany was strongly destroyed by the Allies, about ordinary people who suffered. We're looking forward to a new book by Miron Białoszewski, and I must say it's a major event for us booksellers and for the readers. Miron Białoszewski was a Polish poet, but he is well known from his diaries. He wrote a famous diary from Warsaw Uprising, and he wrote his diaries all his life, and there was a secret diary which was to publish 30 years after his death, and it comes to bookstore in 2 weeks. It's called Secret Diary, no wonder, by Miron Białoszewski, so it would be really interesting for us. And we are looking forward also for a book by Masha Gesse, and it is called A Man Without Face. It's about Vladimir Putin. It's gonna be a world premiere, so Poland and the rest of the world together 1st March. Today on display we have a book by Barbara Demick, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, and a book by Mariusz Wilk, Lotem Gęsi, by Flight of the Goose. If you ever come to Warsaw and you are interested in reportage and non-fiction books, you must visit Wrzenie Świata.
And that was Wrzenie Świata, and that was, well, from the bookstore Wrzenie Świata, that was Mr. Grigorowski, the manager. Sounds like an absolutely fascinating story. I mean, just the idea of being focused solely on reportage and biography, as you're saying. And I wanted to sort of snatch up at least sort of, you know, three of his picks.
Well, I love the sort of sax soundtrack in the distance. Yeah. You can just imagine people with their sort of glasses and their cups of coffee just reading serious books to stimulate the mind in the best possible way.
Well, there were a couple of dispatches last night because as we were saying earlier, we hosted this cocktail party in Budapest last night, and Hugo said he loved the melancholia of everything last
There's something about that part of the world, isn't there?
I'm not really sure about what a sort of a melancholic sort of monocle party would be like. But anyway, I'm sure they'll have full reports for us. We're going to jump now to the west coast of Europe, southwest coast of Europe. This is a little bookshop in Lisbon.
I'm Isabel Nogueira. I'm one of the owners of the bookshop called Podos Livros. Podos lives in Lisbon, in Avenida Marquês de Tomar, near the Gulbenkian Foundation. We are a neighborhood bookshop focused on the relationship, personal relationship with our customers, trying to get them the books they need and they love. It started by that, by trying to meet the needs of the customers. Not necessarily old books, but books that are not available on bookshops because they are not the latest editions. And then we noticed that there was a market there that was a need that was not fulfilled, and we started a new section of old books, and we call it book hunting. The main customers are people from high level of education, I would say, that know what they want, that know the books. And people sometimes came to buy a book before they go to work or before they leave the neighborhood where they live in. So it's important to open early, as a traditional bookshop will do. The most selling this week was Murmúrio do Mundo. It's a travel literature book from a Portuguese author called Almeida Faria, and the publisher is Tinta da China. Then we have The Book of Sand from Jorge Luis Borges, A Dialogue with Science and the Man, which is from Primo Levi and Tulio Regi. We have a biography, Trabalhos e Paixões de Fernando Assis Pacheco, is also from Tinta da China. And then a poetry book, How to Draw a House in English. It's from Manuel António Pina, a Portuguese poet.
That was Paul dos Livros. Bookshop in Lisbon. My Portuguese is not as good as yours, I fear.
We are going to go over to Seoul now, and this is the bookshop Post Poetics.
My name is Jo Wan, working at the bookstore and a graphic design studio called Post Poetics in Seoul. I opened a bookstore in 2006. I was a little depressed with the work for commission projects, so I thought I had to do something by my own. I went to Tokyo for a business trip and I found some interesting business models. So when I came back, I thought if maybe I can do that. So I started in 2006. It's been 6 years. In the beginning, there were several reasons to have a small selection because we didn't have that much budget and we need to be a little different, like totally different from other bookstores. Now we have more budgets and we have more crowds. We have different crowds. So we now have small independent run publications and also nice mainstream kind of publications too. So I think we have nice balance. So we have cookbooks and graphic design books and interior design books. Our bestsellers, Apartamento, which is the lifestyle magazine, but it's different. Interior design also. We don't carry any Korean titles, so it's a little late than the other bookstores because we have to like import, contact the publisher and then import the books. We got the new book from Faden, the book called The Pop Book. So it's about the iconic porcelains from 2,000 years ago or something. Author is Edmund Duval. He's also a ceramist and also doing many TV programs and he's writing many books. That's very interesting. It's not about just one specific theme. So it's about the pot that like from the ancient or the contemporary ones. So it's by the unknown artist, or it's done by like the famous artist like Ai Weiwei. So it's conceptual or crafty, also all different kind of porcelain. So I like it. Yeah, simple concept but nice contents, I think. Yeah,
that was Post Poetics Bookstore in Seoul.
Yes, it's funny when you're in Seoul, there's so many beastly huge bookstores. They've kind of tried to sort of follow.
That's what I imagine.
Yeah, they've tried to follow a bit of the you know, the Barnes & Noble, you know, an X sort of Borders model. So it's like massive stores, but that's maybe not as well executed as Barnes & Noble. But I'm always looking for, you know, the more intimate bookshop. But that's always the challenge of Seoul, is it doesn't quite present itself so readily.
Well, I'm going to steer people now to the film that we've just done on Tsutaya Books in Tokyo, which is exactly, I think, what you're going to talk about.
Well, there are so many emails this week as well from viewers, listeners, readers who checked out the film as well. There was that nice gentleman, Mr. Rosas from Sao Paulo, who wrote a very nice note and said how much he liked it.
I think what's good about the film, it's not so much the film as the space that we were filming, because it does have this incredible lighting, this incredible atmosphere, and peopled by curators who know so much about their specialty of books, and they create this sort of like clubhouse atmosphere that I think is quite unique. I haven't seen anything like
that. But also when you talk, you know, what's very, very interesting as well is I think, you know, any number of analysts probably could have looked at the numbers when they went to build a store and said, this simply isn't going to work because, you know, it's just, on one side it follows the old model because it's, you know, it's massive, and but yet it's so well curated. It's spacious. It's but it's also beautifully done. I mean, they haven't done this on the cheap, which is of course smart. And it has a vitality around the clock. And they said that they've managed to I think, sort of outstripped their number. I mean, they've beaten all of their forecasts. So also, when you talk to people that work there, they're so happy that there's this real sense
of achievement.
And what
I loved about it, it has a travel curator and travel agent. So you'd think everyone's going online.
And he's amazing.
No, they go to a travel agent.
And he's so interesting. He can sort of, he told me he'd traveled to over 100 plus countries or something. He's an amazing, amazing man.
I think that he's the one we feature in our film. So.
We're going to jump to a little bit below the equator, and we're going to head down to New Zealand in a moment. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Review here in Studio 2 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Julian Tobias.
It's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're heading to Wellington in New Zealand to speak to DJ and music producer Christopher Tubbs. Hello, Christopher.
Hello.
I wonder if you can start by just giving us a sense of the music scene there and a bit of the energy, why it's maybe different in New Zealand at the moment.
Well, New Zealand, the music scene is very much a communal scene. Many of the artists out here play in various bands other than their own bands that perhaps they're best known for. So, for example, one of the tracks we have coming up soon, the artist behind the actual record label, the track Perm by Fabulous Arabia, he, in fact, plays in about 8 or 9 bands, all of which are signed to various record labels around New Zealand. And that is not a unique thing. It's very much indicative of New Zealand music as a whole.
Christopher, I first want to just say thanks very much for staying up so late, because it must be around 2 a.m. or something like that your way. When I was in Auckland over Christmas, I came across a wonderful book, they've got books and music combined, but Conk Records in Ponsonby. And I'm wondering, is there anything like that that competes down Wellington way?
Not really anymore, unfortunately. Conch is a very unique proposition. I mean, it's owned by a guy called Kyan McDonald, who is probably one of the sort of founding fathers, in a way, of the DJ scene in New Zealand. And as the, you know, death of vinyl, or as it's perceived, has become more and more severe, unfortunately, you know, in New Zealand, especially New Zealand being so dislocated from the rest of the world and therefore becoming more and more reliant on digital music, has really suffered the most. And Conch is very much a kind of final outpost of all things independent, boutique, and analog, I suppose.
It's a shame, but it's good that they're there. And I also noticed that they're trying to expand at the back as well. It looks like they're moving more into catering, I guess, to maybe offset perhaps some of the falling revenues. But it goes back to one of these interesting things that I saw, though, is just how much also, you know, when you're up by the cash desk and they've got their selects, just, I mean, really, really interesting CDs that they recommended that I picked up. And you get that wonderful sense of personal curation. When you mentioned to Jillian just now about that sense of community, how do bands, make a name for themselves? Is it live performance? Do they rely on George FM? What is it?
It's a combination of things. One of the sort of, backstories to music produced in New Zealand is a lot of artists get government funding in the form of a outfit called New Zealand On Air. And New Zealand On Air is is there to promote New Zealand music on radio, and it has a particular quota of New Zealand music that has to be played on a daily basis on radio. So therefore, there's more opportunity for New Zealand music to actually be heard. Whilst on normal commercial radio stations globally, they're competing against international product from America, from Britain, from wherever. You know, in New Zealand, they have to fulfill that 50% quota.
And is that a good thing for the actual quality of the music coming out, or do you tend to get sort of similar sounds, or is there being really sort of exciting, distinctive sounds coming out?
We ask that as two Canadians, because we're familiar with the same thing as well, that we've got the CanCon thing in Canada as well.
Right. Well, I think what started as perhaps a slightly kind of compromised environment where some of the music actually probably wasn't that great, actually has ended up giving more impetus to the artists who are actually making the music to be better, more self-sufficient, to actually have better production values, actually the final quality of the music to be better. And also, you know, you have bands like, I don't know if you've heard of Fat Freddy's Drop, which is massive band in New Zealand, and also has a huge following as a live act globally. When they go to London, for example, I mean, they'll sell out three nights at the Brixton Academy, and it's it's almost like a en masse cure for homesickness for Kiwis abroad. You know, everyone goes there and has a little cuddle and gets down to some sort of, you know, some dub soul. But, you know, that band in particular really opened a lot of doors for New Zealand music, and proved that it's certainly not commercial music, but it proved something which that was uniquely New Zealand in sound, that very kind of reggae sound, kind of high-tech reggae sound, could actually be commercial. I mean, they sold over 100,000 records in New Zealand alone. The population is only 4 million, so that's quite an achievement.
Speaking of the diaspora, you've got a track lined up for us, The Light by Funk Community. Why don't we have a listen and then tell us a bit about the Funk Community when we come back. And you were listening to the Funk Community here on Monocle 24. This is The Review with me, Tyler Berlin, Jolene DeBias. And down the line in Wellington, New Zealand, we have Christopher Tubbs. They were fantastic. We need to be playing more of them. Tell us a little bit about the Funk Community, Chris.
The Funk Community is Isaac Seeley and a lady called Rachel Fraser. And once again, these guys are really sort of cornerstones of the music community here. Isaac Seeley especially is in bands, very well-known bands in this part of the world, Open Souls, Eru, Danger Spiel, Shapeshifter. He's also a songwriter for people like Holly Smith. And he is this one-man kind of good vibes generating unit. and very much known for this. He's sort of I bumped into him a couple of times in Auckland when I was up there, and he just admits this positivity. And in fact, I think he should really be a diplomat for the tourism board in terms of music culture.
I was wondering, I mean, we had, you know, a part of England in Bristol where there was a great energy at one period in time. Is there any part of New Zealand now that the real great music is coming from? Is there a competition between sort of Wellington and Auckland?
Well, I'm going to have to, you know, fight really hard to keep my journalistic integrity intact, because I'm from Wellington. But I will honestly say, hand on heart, that Wellington has always had a very special thing going on, and I think it's something to do with the geography of it. It's a much smaller city. Anyone who's been to Wellington knows that it's a harbour side city with very high hills around it. You can walk from one end of the city to the other in 30 minutes. And it means that downtown has always had a very compacted heartbeat. Auckland is slightly different. It's a big, sprawling metropolis, or as close to metropolis as New Zealand.
I was going to say, yeah, steady there. I mean, all, these things are all relative.
I qualified it. And they have, I think, have taken a little bit longer to really kind of circle the wagons and create something that they could really call a community musically. I mean, it's far more national now in scope, but I think Wellington has really, especially from the early 90s to the early noughties, created very much a kind of slightly more avant-garde, progressive musical policy than most cities.
We're going to play another song in a moment, but just before we go, where would you say the influences are coming from? This was one thing that sort of, you know, struck me when I was in Auckland and looking at, you know, looking around Conch Records, that you saw, I mean, maybe not in terms of the sound, but, you know, there was also, you know, you felt that you were in the Asia-Pacific region. And, you know, where would you say sort of the center of gravity in terms of inspiration is? Is it, you know, is it looking sort of, you know, north, you know, as far up as Hokkaido? Is it looking across the Pacific? You know, what would you say right now?
I think, actually, a lot of it has to do with Bob Marley's first visit to New Zealand in 1979. It had a cultural impact that, you know, went well beyond his Auckland appearance, and I think it touched at a time that how to describe this best. I think it was a very difficult time for the indigenous people, the Maori in New Zealand, and his songs of disenfranchised race and struggle against the odds really resonated with people in New Zealand, and there's also something about the languid nature of dub reggae that really feels right in a subtropical climate like Auckland. So I think it's a combination of those things. Reggae has just always, ever since 79, just been this huge driving force in New Zealand, and it remains to be today. It's all about the bass down here.
We're going to listen to, on that note, potentially, at least it's perm, not quite Afro, but this is Fabulous Arabia. And that was Perm by Fabulous Arabia. That's a little something, Christopher, to rock out in your batch to, isn't it?
It is exactly that. It is beach music. It just reeks of the Beach Boys, doesn't it?
Very, very nice. I didn't ask you, but both those tracks, are they quite recent, or are they just sort of a best of?
No, they're pretty recent. The Funk Community is from late last year, and the Fabulous Arabia is literally a couple of months old, I think. That's off a label called Economy Records, which is owned by a guy called Toby Lang, and which is probably the most eclectic record label in New Zealand right now, and esoteric, to say the least, and very much a... once again, a joint effort between 12 of New Zealand's most prominent musicians, and really just an outlet for their own crazy little side projects that are in no way commercial, probably have a very limited voice, certainly in New Zealand, but seem to be picking up pace around the world. I mean, that album. It's called Unlimited Buffet. That track is Perm, which is track three off that album. And it is it's becoming very popular in Germany, apparently. I think it's that, you know, kind of left field quirkiness that that really appeals.
Yeah, you could hear them by listening to it in Prenzlauerberg or somewhere like that. Christopher, thanks very much for staying up. Have a very good Sunday.
You're welcome. I hope I've been lucid.
Yes, you have
indeed.
Very much so. And we're going to be adding those definitely to our playlist. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers, and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies, and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Tyler Brulé.
And of course, it wouldn't be a great Saturday without our weekly stack of magazines. Today, we have a fresh selection of titles to help us to dissect them. We're joined in the studio by writer Elias Redstone. Also, he's a curator and an architecture critic, amongst many other things. Welcome.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Good. Well, you've got, it's not the tallest stack I've ever seen in the studio, but that's because of sort of, you know, the volume of some of them. But we'll kick right off. Where do you want to start?
Well, I brought a selection of publications about architecture for you that I pulled out from the Archezines project that I've been working on for the last year or so, that celebrates this resurgence of sort of independent and alternative architecture publications that have been taking place around the world. So I have a selection that sort of represents some of the fanzines and magazines and journals that have all emerged in the last few years. And I pulled out some ones that I thought were pretty, all black and white, all from around the world, showing a variety of approaches and that have all come out the last few months. Mm.
Just before we look at them, why do you think there's been this resurgence right now? That you know, whether you know you've got maybe bigger funded or you know also people you know working with literally a shoestring budget doing titles like this.
I think there are many factors at play, but there's a couple of key ones. First of all, the financial downturns had a big impact on architecture, and it hasn't meant there are less interesting architects out there or people with something to say, but they don't have their usual forms of saying it through commissions of buildings or investment in projects. So the printed pamphlet is one way to actually get their ideas out there. It's affordable, it's cheap, and they can do it alongside their practice. So a lot of these are made by architects as well as artists and designers and other people.
I'm just going to grab the one.
I love it because, I mean, buildings are such a form of expression for the really driven architect. So while they're waiting, they almost have this need to still express their ideas, and they do it through a community of like-minded sort of architects through publications and the written word.
And the other major factor involved is that we're now living in a digital age, and all these publications have emerged while the internet should, you know, be the main form of media. But there is this still this desire to have something in printed form, to have something physical, and to have something that, you know, can last, that lasts longer than the, you know, than it takes to click a web page close.
Right. Mm. Do you think it has to do something with presence, you know, as well? The fact that, you know, you can not, I mean, I'm looking at something called Another Pamphlet right now, which, okay, this wouldn't thump down on the table, but nevertheless, it demands a certain amount of attention somehow.
Another Pamphlet's really interesting. It's a good place to start, actually. It is produced by three architecture graduates from Princeton. They're on issue three. That just came out a couple of months ago. And it launched in 2010. And in their mission statement, they actually say that they're producing this because against the haze of digital distraction, we crave an object to hold our attention, something to touch, to fold, to tuck in our back pocket, to discard. And it's kind of this romantic image.
Yeah. The next one, you've got... Yeah, what's this is the heftier volume.
This is thicker. This is San Rocco, and this was produced by a team of architects that are based between Venice and Milan in Italy. And they're on to issue 3. And this, when I first found it, just really took my attention because it's a really beautifully considered publication. And both of these first two publications, like many of the genre, are open calls for submissions where they'll set a theme, they'll set an agenda, and people can send in. So another pamphlet, this issue is The Future, and they've already stated their next issues are going to look at different themes. The next one's going to be scaleless, so you can email in with your contribution. For them, it has to be up to 300 words, one image, that's it.
It's interesting to see. I mean, you mentioned it at the beginning that you've brought about maybe 6 different magazines. They're all black and white.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, do you think that is a real trying to be exactly the swing of the pendulum away from the digital websites that are all sort of colour and blue?
Or is it just cost? Is it just cost?
A bit of both. I mean, I'm giving you a biased view. I needed to pull out a selection from dozens and dozens of titles that I've been collecting. And I was picking a few that have just come out recently and it started a little trend.
Well, I mean, with internet also of the first two as well, that there's no advertising. I mean, you're also looking at titles as well, which, are truly obviously labor of love and self-funded.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just pass me the one that's pair?
So San Rocco is quite interesting because they've clearly stated that they're not going to go on forever. They have claim that they're only going to produce 20 issues, and they're on their issue Mistakes, and their next issue, which is coming out later this year, issue 4, is called Fuck Concepts Context. So they're trying to be provocative. Future issues, they've named them all on the website, whole 20 issues that they're going to produce in the next 5 years.
So this one, Mistakes, is it literally the theme is about things that go wrong in the architecture building and concept and pictures and
things that go wrong, things that aren't necessarily planned for, and it's text, it's images, all beautifully produced and just really well considered. Other themes that they have coming up include scary architects. And
there's no shortage of those.
Yeah. And 666 ways to be a communist architect.
Right.
I think each one of these topics would be great dinner table.
No, definitely. I like this one that you brought in Pear, which is absolutely beautiful, which is the paper for emerging architectural research. And it is it's just a beautiful, tabloid format, folds over, again, all black and white, with this great sort of, series of arrows, which of course could sort of be, could be representative of houses as well on the cover. And it's from the University of Greenwich.
Well, that was started in 2009 by 3 architects and the designer Avni Patel. And their latest issue 4, is about dwelling. And they've taken this format of sort of newsprint. And when they started off, they were really keen that they wanted to re-establish the fanzine as the primary medium for architectural discussion, research and ideas, and use this format and sort of slightly altered graphic prints as a cover display technique for each issue, responding to different themes. And there's some really interesting content in there. They've got some sort of exclusive sort of sketches and drawings by the architect David Cohn and the artist Fiona Banner from their project that's on top of the South Bank Centre at the moment, A Room for London. They have essays, they have other photography. It kind of gives architects a chance to have an output in a magazine that the usual, more traditional publications don't really allow for. So it's none of these publications are Architectural Review or Architects Journal. They're not trying to be that. They're trying to offer this different space, this sort of alternative arena for thinking or talking about architecture and the spaces we inhabit.
Let's look at, you've got ArcPhoto 2.0. Tell us about that.
ArcPhoto 2.0 actually started as a website in 2002 in Italy. And they started producing a print version last year. They're producing 2 a year. And they are looking at architecture in relationship to art and popular culture. Mm. And it's very much a printed product of a website. So it's the kind of content they'd be gathering sort of in printed form. And it shows one of the ways that people can respond to the internet. Because you can't ignore it. It's out there. We're all using it. And all these publications in one way or another have to respond to it, either working against it as, you know, some kind of declarations against the digital age, or using it in some way either to gather content as a call for submissions or to promote themselves.
When you were putting together Arcazines, did you find that there's one part of the world which is kind of like more industrious in turning out these zines? And, you know, is it sort of from Central Europe? Are the architects there sort of more cerebral and intellectual? Is there one place in the world that you suddenly notice there's a bit of a kind of boom?
Well, I originally thought it was very much sort of a Western concept. You know, America's very good at this, sort of Western Europe's very good at, you know, this tradition of sort of like fanzine culture, publishing culture. But it's actually happening everywhere. So all around the world, whether it's the zine The Weather Ring that's coming out of Perth in Australia, to publications in most Latin American countries, there is this kind of like desire to publish thinking and stories about architecture. But what was really interesting is it wasn't some kind of connected, networked movement. It's not like bloggers where they all kind of link to each other and you know what's going on and they they kind of relate. They were kind of working in isolation, but all sort of like wanting in this moment, for whatever reasons, to publish, to print.
I mean, do you think also part of it's an expression too that the architect's studio has become so digital as well? And I'm also wondering if that's also an expression of, you know, if you only have to look back sort of 20 years ago when you had drafting boards and T-squares and, you know, and mechanical pencils, etc. Do you think that's also something which could be sort of at play under the table potentially?
It totally affects the production and the way that people go about it. People in architecture school are already learning the tools of, you know, manipulating things, using the computers to produce, to design, to draw, and this is shown in the type of publications that are being produced nowadays. There are some publications that are just designed sort of using CAD, and they don't put it out there.
Let's look at let's scapegoat.
Scapegoat. Okay, here we get a bit more political. This is coming out of Toronto in Canada, and it's all about relating sort of capitalism to the built environment and links between architecture, landscape and politics. And so this is sort of a media essays, more considered thinking about these issues and how it's changing today, how sort of what's actually going on in the world, and try to join some of those dots up. So again, they have themes, they have open calls for each issue. This one's looking at materialism. And of course, I forget, on the radio, people can't see what we're looking
exactly.
at. This
is another newsprint. I'm going to describe it. It's a cross between a newspaper and a magazine. In some senses, it looks like a newspaper in terms of the format, but in terms of the content, it seems very much like a magazine.
Yeah, and I would almost say that it's quite sort of esoteric in terms of its tone and pitch. And as you said, it's political. It's interesting that it's come out of Toronto, you know, being sort of a bit of a reaction to capitalism, because I think Julie and I could do a whole, you know, five-part series on what the condominium developers of Toronto have done also, you know, with the lack of sound planning in that city. It's and the other thing that Gillian is looking at as well is how they've broken it up into two sections, though. I mean, it's a really you know, no offense to our fellow countrymen, but doesn't feel very it feels like something you'd get in Berlin or Antwerp.
Yeah.
In terms of its feel. Just before we go, two things I brought along. This is, I don't know if you've seen, this is Bloomberg Pursuit, something which hit the newsstand this week, which is going out to all of Bloomberg's terminal users, so people who are using their trading screens. All over the world, it's been quite a bit of hype. But did you have a look at it yet, Gillian?
No, I haven't.
So this is something which I think it's, you know, there's an enormous number of terminal users. I mean, they're talking that the magazine has a rate base of about 375,000 copies. But clearly kind of going after the how to spend it market, don't you think?
Yeah, no,
this,
right.
This is definitely for people that are not affected in the recession.
No, inside back cover by, it's you know, an ad for Rolls Royce and yeah. and private jets. I was expecting something a little bit more meaty that would feel a little bit more like Bloomberg's Business Week. And finally, I just wanted to bring up, this is just, you know, when you talk about sort of, you know, good design and things like this, is my one of my favorite magazines, which I picked up at Narita Airport. It's called Airstage. You find it in the women's section of the newsstand, and it's just dedicated to people who want to become flight attendants.
I love that.
And it's so it's flight attendant schools. It's how Japanese women can go and work for other carriers around the world. So yeah, the cover story this month is about this Japanese woman who gets a job with Scandinavian Airlines. But yeah, Gillian, you've ended up on the page about just hairstyles at ANA.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think it's fair unless we describe it to listeners again. It has a catalogue of, you know, uniforms, how to sit, how to do your makeup, deportment. It really is like a little catalogue of etiquette and behaviour as well as everything else.
Exactly. And it's, I'll tell you, they could have used a couple of hair tips on my British Airways flight back last night, not to mention some grooming tips. Alice Redstone, that's great. Wonderful wealth of material you brought in today.
Thank you very much. All the publications are currently in the Arcazines exhibition that's on show in Milan.
And it's running till when?
It's running to the 23rd of February, and then the next stop on the world tour is New York, and it'll be at the storefront from Art and Architecture from the 17th of April through to June.
Great. Well, that is all for this week's edition of The Review. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, and it was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our sound engineer was our very dear Casal on the other side of the glass.